Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Gary Vasslash, episode 357 for December 1st, 2016. Alfa Giulia, are you ready for a performance sedan? Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube. Welcome to AutoLine After Hours. As you can see, we're in Northern California for a very important launch, the Alfa Giulia, a sports sedan that is from Alfa Romeo. Joining me here is Tim Stevens, who is the editor-in-chief of Roadshow.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Appreciate it very much. And our very special guest, Reid Bigland, who is the CEO of Alfa Romeo, and we're very glad to have you here with this important launch.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So the first thing I've got to ask is, okay, Alfa Romeo in the United States. Give us a thumbnail history. Where has it been? Where is it going?
Well, first of all, Alfa Romeo is a legendary brand, as you know. It started in 1910 in Milan, Italy, so it's been over a 105-year history. And the history in the United States, we've been pretty much absent for the last 25 or so years. We had the Alfa Romeo 8C, really an exotic two-door coupe that was offered in the U.S., I'd say about 10 years ago, but it's only been this last 18 months with the return of the Alfa Romeo 4C Coupe and 4C Spider, and now behind me here coming up in the next couple of weeks, the Alfa Romeo Giulia hitting our dealerships.
Mm-hmm. So for someone who is not familiar with Alfa Romeo, okay, and they're saying, gee, they're talking about this car, what context does this fit in? I mean, so where are you in the overall scheme of the market?
Well, this is a vehicle that is really true to what has been the greatest Alphas of all time. And when you think about the greatest of Alphas over the past, there's really three defining aspects to an Alfa Romeo: state-of-the-art technology, incredible performance, and of course that gorgeous Italian design and style that people have come to expect from an Italian vehicle. And this vehicle, one of the best things about it, I've often said, is it's not German. It has a real heart, it has a soul. And that's not to take anything away from the German cars, Audi, BMW, and Mercedes. They're great cars, I think everybody knows that. But Alfa Romeo is going to offer a slightly different twist. And from a performance standpoint, there's really nothing on the road that will be able to touch the Alfa Romeo, particularly in the Quadrifoglio version. You might be aware, Gary and Tim, we took it around the Nürburgring, fastest four-door production sedan in the world. We're talking 7 minutes and 32 seconds around the ring, faster than many vehicles from Lamborghini, Porsche, the McLaren SLR. Nobody can really touch
the Alfa Romeo. And this is a production sedan. You got to really emphasize the fact that it did that.
Production sedan, fully stock vehicle. We didn't have any trick wheels on it or any adjustments to the suspension. And it wasn't a ringer that was behind the wheel. It was one of our test engineers from Modena, Italy, that did that lap time.
Well, this morning you had us at the Sonoma Raceway. We have our green tags here to let us get on. And we had the opportunity with some of the engineering drivers who developed this vehicle take us around that. And I got to say, you must have found it to be rather breathtaking.
It is. Certainly, it's a very razor-sharp car, and it does feel more alive than the competitive. But you're entering into a very competitive segment here, looking against the 3 Series and the C-Class. And that's, you know, we've seen the 4C, we've seen the 8C before. Those are kind of niche cars. This is a much more competitive space that you're walking into.
This is gonna go directly into the heart of the premium performance sedan. And you're absolutely right, Tim. BMW 3 Series, Mercedes C-Class, Audi A4 are going to be the head-to-head competitors of this vehicle. But the vehicle also has a lot of Ferrari DNA into it. When you look at the Quadrifoglio version, 2.9-liter twin-turbo Ferrari-derived 505-horsepower engine, 0-60 in 3.8 seconds, and 191 miles per hour top speed. That in and of itself is a differentiator, we feel, in the segment. And then even at the entry level, which will be about the $40,000 range, an all-new 2-liter 280 horsepower engine, 0 to 65.1 seconds. So it's going to be the performance of the Alfa Romeo, in my opinion, that is really going to separate it from the pack. And then the design and style is really icing on the cake.
And you mentioned the Ferrari lineage here, and that motor sounds a lot like a certain motor that's in the California T, but maybe downsized a little bit. What's that relationship like between Ferrari and Alfa at this point?
Well, obviously, from an FCA perspective, we spun off Ferrari about 18 months ago, but the vehicle was designed by two senior managers from Ferrari, all new platform, and obviously the engine, a pretty key component of the car, you know, derives from that of the Ferrari toolkit. So I think we're really blessed from an Alfa Romeo standpoint to be able to leverage what was our brother about 18 months ago. And then, of course, the center of gravity for Alfa Romeo is in Modena, Italy, the headquarters of not only Alfa but also Maserati. Mm-hmm. And at Maserati, we continue to have a very strong relationship with Ferrari for our powertrains.
So how does that relationship work with Maserati? I mean, in...
Well, a lot of shared resources at Maserati. So with respect to our 4C and 4C Coupe, it's built at our Maserati workshop in Modena, Italy, alongside the Maserati GT Gran Turismo as well as the Gran Cabrio. A lot of our engineering resources are shared between Alfa Romeo and Maserati. So we're able to leverage all of the great driving dynamics that exists in a Maserati that is positioned a little premium to Alfa Romeo with all of that technology and know-how going into Alfa Romeo. So I happen to think, because of our relationship with Ferrari and Maserati, is a real asset, as I said, for Alfa Romeo.
And how does the marketing of Alfa Romeo differ from that of Maserati? Because we're talking about some of the same talking points, the Italian passion, the Ferrari lineage, and also with the launch of a Maserati SUV and an Alfa Romeo SUV, it seems like we're treading in some of the same footsteps here.
And you're even seeing it from a distribution standpoint, because you'll see a lot of dual Alfa Romeo and Maserati dealers. You're seeing that right now in the United States. But I think the two brands really complement one another quite well. When you think of the Alfa Romeo product portfolio, 4C Coupe, 4C Spider, really nothing in the Maserati range that competes with that. The Giulia, midsize sedan, as well as our midsize SUV. Again, when we look at our Maserati portfolio, full-size sedan, a new full-size SUV in the Levante, and then the Grand Tours in the GT and Grand Cabrio. So from a showroom dynamic, a lot of complementary skills. From a pricing perspective, we have Maserati slightly premium to that of Alfa Romeo. So we happen to think it's a great combination, two legendary Italian brands in one showroom, and the ability to complement one another quite nicely in the marketplace.
Speaking of the market, how do you feel about the market right now? I mean, your 105-year notwithstanding history, I mean, you're sort of a challenger brand now.
For sure. The car segment throughout all segments, mass market as well as premium, is a bloodbath. It's very difficult out there. And that's where I think we're able to differentiate ourselves and stand out with the Alfa Romeo based upon that technology, performance, and exterior styling. Time will obviously tell. But market is very tough for cars. We're seeing people move away from cars into SUVs. But still, the premium midsize car market is still the largest segment in the world. In the U.S. market, represents 23% of all premium car vehicle sales in the U.S. And the second largest segment, at about 20% of the market and growing rapidly, is the midsize SUV market. So within the next 6 months, we'll have coverage between the Giulia and our new midsize SUV in about 43% of the U.S. market. So we feel we have good coverage, one in a very fast-growing segment in the SUV, and one in a segment that's under a little bit of pressure. But as I said, we feel pretty good about the differentiated offering we're able to bring to market.
Now, we've mentioned the German makes, but Lexus and Infiniti are not giving up on this space.
They're certainly not, and they've carved out their own niche. Of course, Lexus has been incredibly successful in this marketplace and really around quality and a safe, reliable car. I think from a sex appeal standpoint...
Is that damning with faint praise? Hey, I mean, yeah. Come on.
Hey, it's there. But I think the Alfa Romeo Giulia is a completely different end of the spectrum from that of Lexus. And if you want to get your blood going, which I think you did probably on the track, even though it was a little slick out there, I think you know what I mean.
But you did mention quality, and obviously that's something that we think of in high marks from a lot of Japanese sedans. This is a very competitive market, and this is, you know, as a challenger brand, that's something that you have to prove, right? The quality and the reliability of these cars?
Well, I think quality is now a given in this day and age. I think if you think back 30 or 40 years ago, you know, some of the differentiators in the marketplace were probably quality and fuel economy. Mm-hmm. And both of those traditional differentiators, in my opinion, have largely converged. Where style as well as performance, in my opinion, are two of the big differentiators here in 2016 going into 2017. And I think when it comes to those differentiators, I think we're at or near the top of the class, obviously from a performance standpoint, and our quality is at a high level in this day and age at Alfa Romeo.
That will take some time, though, don't you think, to educate the American buyer that this is a brand that can be trusted, especially since it's kind of been here and gone again and here and gone again for a little while?
I think for a brand that's been around for 105 years, mm-hmm. believe it or not, we still have to re-educate, you know, the American market, because we've been out of it for so long as to what Alfa Romeo is and what Alfa Romeo is all about. And I think when people get behind the wheel, hopefully they watch shows like this and read articles from opinion leaders, hopefully it'll get their attention. They'll get down to their Alfa Romeo dealership and see for themselves. And I think when they do, they're going to be impressed.
So speaking of that, so geographically, what are the important markets for Alfa Romeo?
Well, when you look at where most of the premium vehicles are being purchased today, a lot of it is the Sunshine States. You know, California for sure is a critically important market. We're here in Northern California. We revealed the Giulia to the North American marketplace at the LA Auto Show. We're going to reveal the midsize sedan at the Los Angeles Auto Show.
Midsize SUV,
thank you, in the Los Angeles Auto Show. But, you know, throughout California, Texas, into Florida, and then, of course, from a northern perspective, up around New York. Those are the key markets for premium vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And you have all-wheel drive performance, so you may get in some of those snow states?
Absolutely. The Alfa Romeo comes in all-wheel drive in the 280-horsepower configuration, so we feel it's a vehicle that can fit the United States marketplace and Canada from an all-season perspective with the all-wheel drive.
Mm-hmm. It's always a bit of a delicate balance moving into this SUV territory, but still maintaining that brand heritage, especially when we're talking about sportiness being a key of that. How do you maintain that as we move into a bigger, more practical, more family-oriented car?
We have to make sure that the fundamental DNA of Alfa Romeo, and from a performance standpoint, is right there. And we're very confident that when we put the SUV, the midsize Alfa SUV, to its paces, it too will be the fastest SUV in the world around the Nürburgring. Hey, we haven't done it yet, but you just wait and see. And I think it's going to blow a lot of people's Italian socks off when they see the kind of performance that SUV is going to have.
Not everybody wears Italian socks, though.
Yeah, well, it'll blow their American socks off, too.
So, I mean, this emphasis on performance, I mean, do you see Alfa as being the true performance brand versus, say, M or AMG or some of the others?
I think when you benchmark Alfa and the performance trim levels of Alfa to those vehicles, there's no question. And I think it'll be interesting to see if they want to go and try and beat our record at the Nürburgring. But, you know, based upon my head-to-head comparisons of our product with those products, I feel very good about the driving dynamics of Alfa Romeo beyond that of just the engine, because you need the entire package, almost perfect 50-50 weight distribution, the steering, front aero splitter, carbon fiber, and aluminum throughout in the body construction. Mm-hmm. You know, that all goes to it as well.
So another company that we haven't mentioned is Cadillac, and so their V series, and you know, they talk about the Nürburgring a lot too, and that. So do you see that as being a competitor?
We don't see that. You know, we're really benchmarking the European imports for the most part, German as well as the Italian imports, and obviously we're a big part of the Italian imports with Alfa Maserati and even our former sister there in Ferrari. But that's really our competitive set. And I think most of our customers are going to come from a European import perspective.
Mm-hmm. So what is your metric of success? When will you feel satisfied that you're really making it happen for Alfa in the U.S.?
Well, we're really not out to win any sales crowns with Alfa. This is about reestablishing a brand back into the North American marketplace. And I think the barometer for success in Alfa is going to be really 3 to 5 years out. We need to get the brand established We need to be true to our beliefs with respect to the product, deliver top quality and top performance products in the marketplace. And I'm confident if we can do that, which I feel very good about with the Giulia, the SUV, as well as the 4C, that success will have a tendency to take care of itself. So right now, our focus is really on the product, and we'll worry about the sales a little bit later, but we need to be true to our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And to continue that growth, you're going to need more products, right? And obviously, this was a pretty substantial investment to make this platform. Where do you see this platform going next?
Well, this is an incredible platform. So it will house the midsize SUV, house the Giulia, and we've got a few other things on the drawing board as well that I'm just not at liberty today to talk about. But, you know, penetrating only 43% of the premium market is not that bad with really, you know, two of the four main products in the marketplace, but we're looking to go a little bit deeper into that premium performance market. So you're going to have to just stay a little tuned for that.
So are all the guys in Auburn Hills jealous of you when you come rolling into the parking lot with one of these?
You know, we really keep it very separate from that of Auburn Hills. You know, our Maserati headquarters in North America is in New Jersey. It's not in Auburn Hills, and it's really a separate and distinct group in the Auburn Hills area that is focused in on Alfa Romeo with most of the engineering, as I mentioned, in Modena, Italy, shared with Maserati, and very little involvement from our mass market operations. And we've done that deliberately from a distribution perspective, you know, completely separate from our mass market operations. The engineering, the marketing, and the brand team is unique and distinct from that of our mass market. And I think we have to do that in order to be credible in the marketplace.
Okay. So with that, Reed, thank you very much for being here and for having us out here in this wonderful part of the world and letting us drive that car. So
thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So we're going to take a break and hear from our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, and we're back. We have Richard Cox, Director of Alfa Romeo North America and Head of Alfa Romeo Global Product Planning. Now, I got to ask you, the global product planning, whole world?
Whole world, yes. So Europe, NAFTA, and then Asia Pacific, including China.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the U.S. market differ from the entire globe from a perspective of Alfa Romeo in particular?
So we've been selling Alfa Romeo in all the other markets. So in Europe, as well as in most of Asia Pacific and Japan and Australia. But then it's marking its first return back into the North America market after about a 20-year absence in North America.
So for the new car, the Giulia, clean sheet, you guys started saying, hey, we've got to come up with something
yes.
else. So what did product planning do to determine what was needed to help reestablish?
So this was really working then a lot with the designers, the engineers, everyone that's in Modena, Italy. The birthplace then, if you will, for Alfa Romeo is in Milan, but Italy is really the home of Alfa. So for this, if we're going to mark a return then for the brand, we want to ensure then that this is a vehicle that really differentiates from the rest of the class. So back to our roots, going back and taking a look at some of the best Alphas in history, and then making sure then we deliver upon those promises of great styling, great performance, and of course a rear-wheel drive architecture that is lightweight, fun to drive.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a lot of time talking about Nürburgring times
yes.
with Reed just a moment ago. How important is that from a product planning standpoint? I mean, is that actually a goal of the car to be the fastest in this segment?
Yeah, what we want to set aside is, you know, that it is an overall, I think the Nürburgring time is a message overall that this car is incredible balanced performance. So from acceleration off the line, through the corners, this is a vehicle that equally at home, thanks to our DNA switch, you can put it into race mode and it is going to be a high performer vehicle on the track. But at the same time, you can also adjust the dial and then make it a very comfortable vehicle for day-to-day, you know, rush hour traffic.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned sort of in passing that there are two variants of this car,
yes.
with the top variant being the Quadrifoglio, which I can't
Quadrifoglio,
say.
Yes.
So explain that car. I mean, the meaning of that name and why that's important to Alfa's history.
Yeah, so I mean, the Quadrifoglio, that's a name that really dates back then, if you will, to 1923. So we had a stacked racing team back in the day. So everyone from, you know, Enzo Ferrari and then really Ugo Savacci is kind of the signature racer at that time. He was a vehicle or a driver that was always the second place finisher, put a four-leaf clover on the side of his car, instantly first race out, he wins. So then it just became a symbol of good luck. And unfortunately, he passed away the one time that he did not put that four-leaf clover on the side of his car. But really, it's a testament then to high performance. We've been using it ever since in all of our high performance vehicles and also all of our race cars. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we carry forward to today, that it will only be on our truest, fastest high performance vehicles.
And it really does feel like a very different car from the base model. I had the chance to drive them both earlier.
Yes.
And there's a really big difference between the two. I mean, I've driven the M3 versus the base 3 series, and I've driven the C63 versus the C-Class. This feels like a much wider gap, honestly, between those two classes. Is that really intentional to make this really more of an extreme, more of an outrageous car?
Well, I think what we've done is we tried to ensure then that we, you know, recognizing who our markets is. You mentioned going back to the product planning and, you know, making sure we know who our customer is. So Quadrifoglio customers, they want that all-out high-performance performing vehicle, probably only going to drive it a few months of the year. Not rack up a ton of miles. We also recognize that the people who are driving the Giulia and the Giulia Ti, they're going to drive this vehicle every single day. So put it in dynamic mode. You can get a lot of that high performance characteristics, tremendously responsive steering. You get the carbon fiber drive shaft, all the lightweight 50-50 weight distribution on the vehicle. But at the same time, it is a vehicle you can drive in rush hour and very comfortable every day.
Yeah, the transmission is a very nice transmission that you have across the board in these cars.
Yes.
So they're all 8-speed ZF transmissions.
And yep.
100 microsecond.
Yes, 100 millisecond.
Millisecond. So,
yes.
So the question is that okay? What is a normal transmission shift at? I mean, it's...
You would... most of the transmissions out there, you're looking at 250, 300, 400 milliseconds. I mean, this is very fast when it comes to shifting. And it's also, you can make it very smooth or... Just by adjusting the DNA switch, you can also, you know, give you that kind of kick in the back so that you really feel it, especially in the Quadrifoglios. I'm sure you saw today out on the track. It's a vehicle that it's got the signature gargle from the exhaust that kicks back every time upshifts or downshifts that signals this is a high-performance vehicle.
And I have to ask, manual transmission available in the U.S.?
No manual transmission in the U.S. And I think part of that, if you look at it, number one, I mean, declining sales of manual transmissions. And really, I think the other side of it, the new manual is the paddle shifters on the automatic. You can put it in manual mode. You are in complete control. You get the benefit of 100 millisecond shifts, and you control upshifts and downshifts. There's no intervention.
And that is totally true. I was bouncing off the rev limiter in the car earlier today. So just I can totally vouch for that statement. Mm-hmm.
So why a sedan?
So I think the first thing is it is the largest premium segment globally and also in the U.S. marketplace. And then also at the second time, you know, the second largest then is the midsize UV. So we're going after the heart of the market. We've got the 4C that's covering the specialty segment, which is really kind of, you know, part of Alfa's heritage, performance and race cars, and now going after the largest segments in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking from the point of view of your global product planning,
yes.
China. Does this car have a role there for Alfa?
Yeah, it does indeed. If you look at the largest segments in China, the full-size sedan or E-sedan has traditionally been one of the largest, but right behind it is the mid-size sedan segment and then the mid-size UV segment as well. So whether it be in the European marketplace, where of course they also have a couple of other, you know, hatches that are very dominant there as well, we've got players in those segments, and then our global vehicles are the Giulia, the new midsize UV, and then the 4C.
What sort of trims are Chinese buyers looking for versus the rest of the world? Are they looking for the Quadrifoglio, the extreme performance, or is it a different sort of mix that they're going for?
It's going to be a smaller percentage of the sales. Probably the highest percentage would be here in North America, followed then by Europe, and probably lastly in China. But, you know, if you look at it from a Giulia and the Giulia Ti mix, it's going to be their disproportionate percentage of their sales.
Do you have a feel of what that percentage might be, or a ballpark for what you're expecting the Quadrifoglio to be versus the other models of the Giulia?
No, we're gonna see. I mean, I don't think we're honestly gonna be able to build enough of the Quadrifoglio based upon some of the initial demand that we've seen out there. It's been phenomenal. So we've got a lineup of people that are looking to get into the car. I think into the car in general, but mostly into the Quadrifoglio.
So it surprises me that you said that the U.S. market would be larger for that car than Europe, where there are things like the Autobahn. So is this just purely because of nationalistic buying habits that...
No, I think there's a, call it this, you know, number one, the return of Alfa back into the North America marketplace. There's a phenomenal number of Alfisti or Alfa enthusiasts in the North American marketplace. And hey, we love our power. Mm-hmm. So Here you get a vehicle that's got phenomenal looks on it, you know, Italian roots, Italian built, and at the same time runs 191 miles an hour and 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds. What's not to like?
The highways that don't allow you to go 191 miles an hour in the U.S. That would be one
but thing. You can get to that speed limit faster than any other car.
True, very true.
So, of the cars, so you have a twin turbo in the four-cylinder, and it gets 280 horsepower?
Yeah, 280 horsepower in the turbocharged four-cylinder, 16-valve, all-new engine. And so 280, you put that up against the competition, it's significantly faster than the competition, 0 to 60, 5.1 seconds, and onto a top speed of 149 miles an hour.
And this is basically the entry model.
That's our entry model. So yeah, you start looking at your full showroom of Alfa Romeo vehicles, 4C at 4.1, 5.1, and 3.8. This is Alfa staying true to rear-wheel drive, high performance. This is who we are.
Mm-hmm. And the V6 kind of comes from Ferrari in a way. Is there any chance that this four-cylinder might percolate back up? Because you got to figure Ferrari's going to continue downsizing as emissions continue to get a little bit.
I can't speak for Ferrari, mm-hmm. but you know, certainly from our standpoint, we are very fortunate to have some of the top engineers from Ferrari that assisted on this program. For the Giorgio project, the all-new Alfa Romeo Giulia, and the architecture itself. So everything from the light weighting, the 50-50 weight distribution, to the 2.9-liter all-new V6, you know, we're grateful for some of that assistance. And that also has paid off in dividends on the Giulia and the Giulia Ti with the 280 horsepower as well.
Is there a space that is where you guys will not go? I mean, in terms of size, larger, smaller,
I think we need to...
Bigger.
Anything that wider. We assess, I think, from...
full-size truck, maybe.
Yeah. Well,
yes, we've seen others do that. No, I think for Alfa, we've got to stay true. You know, we love sports cars, we love performance, and we've got to stay true to who Alfa is. So this means, you know, rear-wheel drive bias vehicles, high performance or class-leading performance, and never forgetting the focus on the driver, and obviously everything else that the customer is looking for in the vehicle from a technology safety standpoint as well. Mm-hmm.
It's a great car, I think.
It is, absolutely.
You guys have done your homework, clearly.
No, we're really proud of this. This is something that no one took lightly on the Alfa team. We're all, you know, honored to be a part of it, and then to ensure then that we bring back to marketplace a real world-class vehicle. So we're very excited to see it launch into the marketplace.
Yeah, I can't wait to see him on the road myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with that, Richard Cox, thank you very much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thanks. No, my pleasure.
Take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Hey, we're back. So we're joined with another very important player in the development of the Giulia, Fabio De Muro, yeah. Who is the vehicle line executive for the vehicle.
Yes.
So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Tim, why don't you... start and ask him about those carbon fiber.
Yeah, I want to talk about all the detailed, nerdy engineering bits of the car, but talk me through the engineering of the car. This is a whole new platform. What are some of the key features that differentiate this car from the 3 Series or the C-Class or some of the others in the segment?
Yeah, we have been focused from the beginning on some peculiar, especially on the material, and then also on some chassis, dynamic, peaky performance have been established through a very important new unique contents on this vehicle. So starting from the material side, for example, something is unique on this vehicle is the transmission shaft is done in full carbonium. That has been done for weight, of course, to reduce the weight of the vehicle. It's been one of the key factors along the development of the vehicle from the beginning, but also because we want to have something that will allow us to give us something unique that is important for this car, because the brand needs something from the beginning to be established as absolutely unique into the market, into the competition. Beside the material, there are some unique and special contents, technical features, like the chassis, the main control. This is the brain of the car. Is a module that for the first time we have put in our vehicles into the car that controls the active system controls of the vehicle, controls the torque vectoring, controls the active shaft, the active shutter, and the also the suspensions. And as the brain of the man, the brain of the car is this module, interacts with all this module taking the input from the back, from the road, taking the input from the driver, and giving contemporary to all the other modules the best signals, the best input to have always in mind the best driving performance for the driver.
So as you're driving the car, it keeps the car stable. It sends the power to which wheel would be
correct.
Most beneficial.
Feels the input from the wheels, mm-hmm. from the sensors, the input from the steering wheel comes from the driver. Any kind of dynamic collateral input will come. So all this input goes to the chassis control unit that, of course, interacts with all the other modules to give the best driving performance.
So there's one system that controls everything, making
yes.
all the decisions and
yes.
bringing the car together into
correct.
Kind of a homogeneous package, which is something we see on the 488 as well that they've just deployed. Is there any family lineage there?
No, I don't think so, that we have family lineage.
Uh-huh.
Another system that is unique on this vehicle is the integrated brake system. So for the first time, we have integrated the braking system with the booster, having one single module. And again, this has been done for packaging reason. This has been done for light weighting, because again, the weighting was one of the key factors of success of this vehicle, and is unique in the world. It's the first time that this application is done, and the Alfa Giulia has it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, before we leave the materials, I mean, so the carbon fiber just is not used for the drive shaft. I mean, you've got panels.
Several components.
So the front fascia.
We have the QV version, we have the roof, we have the hood. And it's important to say why the hood has been done in carbon shaft, because in carbon, because the weight of the engines on the V6 is higher of the four cylinder, and of course to counterbalance the higher weight, we have put the hood in carbon in order to reduce the weight of the front, because to reduce the weight of the front is very important. Of course, the engines has been done all in aluminum, so we have done the best that we can to try to reduce the weight on the front. But doing that in the carbon fiber will further decrease the weight in that area. And these are not the only parts that are done in carbonium on the QV version. So there are other ones
right.
that we have done. So the side molding are in carbonium and other components.
And then you have some aluminum, not only for the engine and suspension,
yeah,
but...
Yes, the door, for example, are done in aluminum. And this is also has been very important for weight. And there are also other components done in aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And so how big of a factor is weight in the performance of a car like this versus outright power? Because there's no lack of power in this car either.
Absolutely. This is crucial, because for a fuel economy, we need to balance, of course, from one side the top performance. On the other side, we need to have the right lighter weight as possible. And it's also important to say that decreasing the weight sometimes goes in contrast with the higher rigidity. But using this special material, keeping it in the right place, we can have torsional stiffness, as important it is, with a lightweight, balancing both things together. And this is one of the key success to have the best driving response, the best drivability from mm-hmm. a car.
Well, it seems to me there's a third element, which is aerodynamics. So we have power, weight, and aero.
Yes.
So we've talked about how this has Italian design. Now, did the stylist come to you and bring you a package that was very exotic, and you said, "Guys, no, this is not happening"?
Well, yeah, the CD, the drag efficiency, has been one of the key successes of this vehicle. On the QV version, we have reached something around 0.22-0.23.
Wow.
And also, we have also been able to do with this active splitter in the front a very successful behavior of the car, because that is also controlled by the chassis control unit. And when we need more drag, less drag efficiency, the active splitter is activated, giving a different behavior to the car where required.
Mm-hmm. It actually has practical applications too. I mean, we're used to race cars kind of dragging their nose along the road whenever you go over a speed bump or that kind of thing, but the splitter on this actually lifts up at lower speed, so that has a practical consideration too.
Right. It helps the insurance cost
a little bit. Now, we talked about the torque vectoring rear differential a bit before, and that surely makes the car a little bit more agile feeling in the corners.
Yeah.
A lot of manufacturers are bringing rear steering into cars like this. Was that something that was ever in consideration for this car, or something that would benefit it?
Yeah, from the beginning we have taken in consideration. The torque vectoring has a really good benefit, because with two clutches, is capable to give from 0 to 100% of the torque to one wheel, differently from the other wheel. So every wheel can go from 0 to 100% independently. It is very important to have the best dynamic possible on a vehicle like this.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the development of this car really focused on the driver. Could you talk us through what you did to make sure that this truly is a driver's car?
Correct. So at the beginning, first of all, this pool of technical engineers that came from some from the Fiat group, very specialists, very enthusiastic people. Other one came from Ferrari. They came together in Modena, think about from zero, from scratch, okay, what we need to do to make the best car ever from a driving perspective. And starting from there, they started to think about technology, unique contents and so on, but most important than that, they've been focused from the beginning from who is most important of all is the driver. So how to be sure that the driver will really experience the best performance when the car will be finished, and that sometimes it's too late when we come into the industrialization phase and we found, okay, this is what we didn't want to do. To be sure that the driver was really focused and was really at the center, a very special virtual simulator has been used at the beginning of the project. This virtual simulator has been correlated with a real feeling that subjectively the driver can experience driving the vehicle with the characteristics of the vehicle in terms of structural rigidity and so on. And so what happened was that we called some driver that tested some vehicle. Then these input data were embedded inside the virtual car, the virtual simulator. And changing parameters inside the virtual simulator, they will be able to feel into the virtual simulator what can really be in the future be experienced by the real car. And doing that in advance, we have been able to focus on the real package, the best package, to find the best balance between suspension, damping, structural rigidity. Then when we went in production, they were successful. And for a timing for a program where the timing is important, it's really important to catch the right package from the beginning and not start doing several loops at the end and then be lost.
So you had the subjective input of a driver.
Correct.
And then you took that
inside a virtual simulator. The virtual simulator linked together the subjective input with the technical data. And when we changed it into the virtual simulator, different technical data, different packages, suspensions, different input, they could feel the difference in the virtual simulator. Mm-hmm. And the driver that experienced it say, okay, this is better than this one is the right, it is the right package, please go ahead. And when we went in production, we found, oh, that's good, it works.
that's pretty fascinating to me because, you know, as an American anyway, we think of an Italian car being built with passion and being built with artistry, but not being built from a driving simulation, you know, a digital simulation of the real world. It's pretty fascinating to me that that's actually the origin of what we see behind us now.
Think about that. The original team has been done by people that came from Ferrari. They have a completely different mind, different vision. Mm-hmm. And this has been one of the key success of this team, of the development. Mm-hmm. Because they brought inside what they do generally for this fast car. And this has been good for us, mm-hmm. good for everybody.
I think it's good. So with that, Fabio Di Muro, thank you very much
for your
time.
Thanks.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you. So we'll be right back. We're going to hear from our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. Tim and I are now joined with Rebecca Lindland, who is the Senior Director at Kelley Blue Book. Rebecca, thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to be talking more about the Alpha and Tony Quiroga, who is a senior editor at Car and Driver magazine.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Based out here in
Los Angeles.
Not sunny California.
No.
So, Tony, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking all about Alfa Romeo. We've been talking about the Giulietta. So we've had Reid Bigland on talking about it, Richard Cox, Fabio Di Muro. So we've sort of like stepped it down. So I'd like you guys to talk a little bit about how you see this car fitting into the market. Now, Rebecca, you know all about markets, and so that's why we have you here. And Tony, you've driven more than a fair share of
the competition,
for sure. And then Tim, of course, is our resident expert on technology. So, Rebecca, let's start with you. And where does this fit into the market? I mean, it seems to me that this is a huge challenge that the Alfa Romeo team has.
It definitely is a challenge, but it's not insurmountable. I mean, one of the things that, you know, driving the car today, it's really different than a lot of the stuff out there. And, you know, cars, especially in the midsize luxury sedan segment right now, it is very challenging, as Reed mentioned, but it still is also the largest segment still, and especially globally. And that's one thing that we have to look, when we think about brands like Alfa, we have to think about them on a global basis. Mm-hmm. There is demand in other parts of the world for this type of vehicle, and they've done great with economies of scale, making a vehicle that is appealing to the U.S. market with all-wheel drive, which is really important. I live in Connecticut, and all you really see from the other manufacturers are, you know, setups of all-wheel drive. Mm-hmm. But what was fun about this car is that there's no compromise when you're getting that all-wheel drive feeling. You know, it still is a rear-wheel drive, and all you have to do is look at the proportions to say, wow, this thing is really, you know, definitely rear-wheel drive, definitely set up for performance. So I think that there's actually a place for this vehicle amongst all the other luxury sedans that are out there today.
Mm-hmm. And you think that'll be enough to overcome some of the fears that American buyers might have about this being a new brand or an unknown brand to a lot of people, and perhaps a brand with not the greatest reliability history and knowledge for a lot of people?
One of the things that I really like about what they've done is that they have not ignored their heritage. And nowadays, especially with younger buyers, they actually really appreciate that. They have, you know, they'll go online, they'll do a Google search, they'll get the history of the brand, and they want the cars to be an acknowledgement of that, to be a celebration of that history. And they also, a lot of millennials actually have a very close relationship with their grandparents. And so their grandparents that, you know, maybe know these cars from the past and know them from their history, understand the brand, they can relate to that. And so I think that they've actually done a really great job of embracing their heritage and staying true to their original bloodlines.
So Tony, how does this car fit in the scheme of vehicles with which it'll go up head-to-head with?
Well, clearly the Quadrifoglio is going up against some of the cars you've already, I think, mentioned, like the Cadillac ATS-V, the BMW M3, the Mercedes-Benz C63. Those are sort of the, you know, high horsepower, the high performance versions of these midsize sedans. And I think it fits in really well in there. It's unique. It sounds unique. The steering is wonderful. The body is really solid. It's really nice to drive, and it really plays up being a rear-wheel drive car. And it's, I think it's fantastic. I really enjoyed it. And it has the most power in its class as well, which is interesting.
It almost feels like a step above the M3, like closer to the GT4 almost, or almost, you know, kind of reaching in that direction almost.
Yeah, I mean, it has more horsepower than the water-injected M3, the GTS. Yeah,
GTS,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It feels quick. It'll be interesting to see what the actual performance numbers are. I mean, they're quoting numbers of 0 to 60 under 4 seconds, which it could do, I guess. I don't know. It's pretty wet out here, so it's kind of difficult to
today,
test that
probably.
Today. Yeah. And as far as the 2-liter car, nice car. After driving the Quadrifoglio, though, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a big fall. But, I mean, also there's a huge price difference. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, especially with 4-wheel drive. Or with all-wheel drive against
Audi. So
that's
only available with the four-cylinder engine, not...
Yeah, the all-wheel drive is only available with the four-cylinder engine. And it seems like a nice engine. It seems pretty powerful. I spent less time in that car today than I did in the Quadrifoglio, but it's, I mean, it feels pretty nice. I liked it.
Yeah, it's definitely still a strong car and a fast car. The turbo lag was much more noticeable in that engine than in the 6, but definitely the power delivery is still strong. It's still a very, very quick car.
It's still likes to rev, and it still makes a nice noise. And it plays that up in the ways sometimes the Germans sort of downplay it.
You know, the thing that I found to be most noticeable in terms of driving this car was the seating position compared to some of its competitors. It seemed more of a sports sedan, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's almost as though, you know, lower and more planted. And I just wonder, you know, how does that play in an era where people are interested in high age points.
But people aren't buying this for the same reasons. And even when you talk about reliability, Tim, like, that's what other brands are for.
Well, and I suppose they'll buy the SUV that's coming, sure, which is on this platform. They wouldn't be interested in this necessarily.
Right. And so somebody that's that knows the brand, that's an early adopter to this brand, I think that they'll be really pleasantly surprised if it turns out to be really reliable. If it turns out to, to fulfill the promises that they've made, then that's a bonus for them. But you're really buying the lifestyle and experience that goes along with driving, a car like this.
So who do you think will buy this? Give me a sketch of that person.
Yeah, you know what? I do think that, it was funny. We were just looking at sales of some of the lower slung sports cars and how they're really on a steep decline, in part because baby boomers are aging and those things are harder to get out of, whereas something like
knees,
this,
hips,
exactly, and so something like this vehicle gives you that same great performance that you may get from a two-door low-slung sports car that was totally appropriate for you in your 20s and 30s. But now, as baby boomers move out of midlife crisis mode and into retirement, this is such a great, what a fun car to drive in retirement. But it also can add...
But it's not orthopedic.
No, but what I'm saying is that, but it also adds such incredible, one of my driving partners, we were talking about, just caffeine to your commute. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like just a super fun car. And again, I can also see younger buyers buying this as that, I mean, I hate to even use the word practical with it because it's so much more fun than that. Mm-hmm. But it still is a four-door sedan, and there's plenty of room in there and such.
Do you have ISOFIX in the back for the child seats?
I'm sure.
They have to, yeah. Yeah, everyone does.
And a great big trunk, too.
Yes.
I love that we're in an era now that you can have a car like that, you dial the knob up to race, and it is incredibly harsh, loud, snappy throttle. It just feels like it wants to bite you all the time. But then you can turn it back down. It's incredibly comfortable and nice. And so, you can buy the car that you think you need. Like, you think you want that incredibly harsh sports car, but
right.
you obviously don't want that all the time. And you can have one car that can do both.
And it's great to have those options.
Yeah.
That there's some days, especially like if you're out on the weekend and you're doing something more fun and you're on more fun roads, mm-hmm. you can make that instant adjustment.
Okay, but this is becoming somewhat common in
sure.
a number of cars, the ability to adjust this. I mean, so... You do a lot of testing of vehicles. How does its adjustability compare, do you think?
The car's got a pretty huge bandwidth, but the competition does too. I mean, an M3 can settle down and it becomes quiet and it rides softer when you change it to a different mode. The same with the Mercedes-Benz. And this car does it as well. I don't know if it does it any better or worse. I'd have to drive them back to back. It's sort of hard to say. But, I mean, the bandwidth of this car is pretty, pretty wide, especially if you switch it to normal and the shocks are in normal mode. The ride's pretty pleasant. It doesn't crash. It's not noisy. Mm-hmm. And then you switch it to race, and like you said, it's loud and it's ready to go.
Probably the disadvantage here to compare it to something like the BMW is that you can't really customize those settings. You can't say, I want stiff steering with soft suspension but a sharp throttle response, for example. You're pretty well dialed into what has been engineered into
the
car.
So one of those six Italian...
But that makes me kind of happy.
Yeah?
I like that because I think they nailed the steering on this car.
Yeah, I agree.
And BMW just gives you a bunch of options and none of them are really that wonderful. And it doesn't really improve the feel. It doesn't really improve the responsiveness of the steering. This car, as soon as you get in it, that was one of the things, before I left the parking lot, I was like, whoa, this feels different. And it feels really sharp. It feels really connected. It feels really, really nice. And that was sort of amazing to me.
So do you know what kind of steering gear it has in it?
It has an electromechanical assist.
And
it's a rack and pinion. It's a rack and pinion.
And so how does that compare with what you'd find in a BMW or...
Well, that's what everyone's gone to at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's all tuning. It all comes down to tuning.
Mm-hmm.
And the quickness of the ratio.
Yeah, exactly. But it just feels great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
It feels really, really nice. It doesn't feel really nervous. Once you sort of adjust to... Because I think it's around 2.2 turns lock to lock.
Right.
Which is fairly typical for the segment. It's a little bit quicker, but it just feels better. It feels more responsive. It really does.
So speaking of tuning, now one of the points that they were making was that there's a center knob to control the technology. Mm-hmm. So Tim, you got to talk to us about the interface in that car and what you think about it.
Right. So in the higher-end spec, there's an 8.8-inch display, which is a non-touchscreen. So your sole means of control is the dial in the middle, which is very similar to the command system for Mercedes or the iDrive and BMW, that kind of thing. It's a lot more limited than those systems. It doesn't have the depth of features that a lot of them do. But it is very easy to use. It has a lot of quick functionality. You can push the knob up, for example, to get to kind of this quick list of all the major features you want to, navigation and audio and tuning, that kind of thing. So it's pretty quick and easy to use. It doesn't have, you know, you can't go into 15 levels of depth and customization like you can in command, but you also don't get lost down in there as well, which, you know, you mentioned you can kind of tune the BMW to be what you want it to be, but you can also kind of make it feel kind of awful. The same thing with the navigation system and everything else. It doesn't have the depth of features that you might want if you're a real power user, mm-hmm. but it also won't leave you buried in some submenu without having without finding a way to get back out.
So, again. I mean, I just was driving an Audi Q7 last week, and it has a knob, uh-huh. and you move the knob around. I mean, now, I didn't find that to be too deep to get things done,
right.
And they're using Google technology and so on and so forth. I mean, that isn't in this car. I mean,
right.
So is it just the nature of a sports sedan versus more of a mainstream vehicle?
I think it's more of a nature of more of a niche manufacturer at this point. It doesn't have the partnerships, it doesn't have the Google integration, doesn't have CarPlay and Android Auto, that kind of thing. It doesn't have the active data connection to be streaming things like satellite imagery in Google Maps like you'd find in Audi. And it doesn't have the overwhelming selection of input methods. You only have that knob. Like in Audi, for example, you'll have the knob. You can spell things with a touchscreen. You can use the touchscreen. And in the BMW 7 Series, you can use gestures and things like that, too, and presumably in the 5 Series as well. You just got that knob. So if you like it, that's good. If you don't like it,
I think it's like a conscious decision, too, because, I mean, in the Maserati, you have that FCA screen that's also in the Charger and the Dart. Here, they've avoided that completely. It has its own system, and you know, for better or for worse, you know, it doesn't look like the one in a, you know, $20,000 Dart or a $25,000 Charger, but, you know, you lose some of the functionality, you lose some of the richness in the screen, you know, the map doesn't draw as quickly as you might hope, and you don't have, like, the touch control that you do in the Audi and I think the Mercedes. So you lose some of that, but then you also get a unique interface, which, you know, it doesn't remind you that you're in a Chrysler product like sometimes the Maserati does.
Exactly.
So how important is technology to customers for vehicles like this? Do you think at all? I mean, technology that is, you know, interfaces versus technology that is wonderful steering.
Right. Kelley Blue Book runs a survey every quarter called Brand Watch, and we look at 12 different factors that, and people rank them based on importance. And in luxury sedans, it actually generally ranks in the lower two-thirds of the 12 factors that we look at in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. There's others that are much more important for consumers. Obviously, durability, reliability, safety, driving performance, looks, exterior, styling is a key one as well. They want that combination of emotional and practical features. Mm-hmm. And I think also, you know, nowadays our phones are doing so much for us when it comes to navigation, when it comes to some of those features. And so if you can get your phone connected, for a lot of people, they're pretty good with that.
Did you guys try connecting your phones? I did not.
No. I didn't get a chance to.
That's such a big thing in Consumer Reports Quality Index, too.
Right.
It was like that dings people that, you know, if it's a difficult process. And I wish I had tried it. I think I might try this evening.
From a Bluetooth perspective, it's pretty easy. It's the same thing as everything else. But, yeah, unfortunately, like app connectivity, something that's lacking compared to
right. There's no Apple CarPlay and there's no Android.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, you do have some of the more active technology safety features, a lane departure warning, that kind of thing, which, interestingly, I found it activates speakers, so it lets you know by sound. It doesn't buzz or chime or anything, but it uses the left speaker if you're wandering left and the right speaker if you're wandering right, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
But it's not an active steering thing where it won't push you back into the lane as well, which is so good and bad.
What was the nature of this noise that you heard?
It's almost flatulent sounding, actually. It's kind of a low rumble sort of thing.
I thought that was my co-driver.
I kind of had to excuse myself and say, that was not me. That was the active safety system keeping us.
So it kind of mimics a rumble strip type sound.
It's a little bit of a rumble strip kind of noise.
On the car I drove.
Yeah, you did.
So it was all blamed on me.
that was a bit of a surprise. And it
Dinner.
Required a bit of explanation between myself and the co-driver.
So You were suggesting that cars like this are not necessarily a primary purchase yet. I mean, if you get the four-cylinder base version, I mean,
Isn't
that like a car that anybody could drive every day?
Right.
You know, and again, it's got good fuel efficiency and start-stop system.
Yeah. No, I think that we're seeing some really good, solid demand from younger buyers for these types of vehicles as their only vehicle. And then, I feel like there's a lot of appeal across different generations and male to female as well, because I see it as a safe car. It's a lot of fun to drive, and again, if you've got a commute going on, what fun would this be?
I keep thinking of other brands that haven't been mentioned. Jaguar is now coming back into the space.
For sure.
And with the F-Pace, so they have their SUV.
I mean, that F-Pace, I drove it a couple weeks ago, and that was easily my favorite ride of the day. I mean, I loved that thing. It was such a sexy SUV. And from a female perspective, I felt like it did everything I wanted it to do from a practical standpoint, again, but it was so emotional. Like, I absolutely fell in love with the high belt line. I sat and I was like just all cozied up in there. And I absolutely loved it.
So what do you think about, they've got a new platform, they've got new engines. I mean,
they do. Right now they're all six cylinders at this point in the XE. They're yet to launch their 2-liter turbo. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays against that. But yeah, they're playing up driving dynamics. They're playing up design. They're playing up a lot of the things that Alfa are playing up to and hoping to, reach buyers.
And the heritage.
Yeah, exactly.
So is it a case?
And it's a brand not necessarily known for its reliability either.
Right.
So that's also, something that they have to face
overcome
and deal with.
Yeah. So the Alfa more flamboyant and the Jaguar more reserved, or
I suppose not so. Much? Yeah, if you had to classify them in some way, yeah, definitely.
So. With you see that Lexus is trying to amp up its game in terms of its sports performance and the F and so on, and Infiniti's got that guy from Game of Thrones driving very quickly.
I don't do the whole Game of Thrones thing. Sorry.
Yeah, well, okay. I thought you might know,
but Gary.
Yeah.
Is it becoming very crowded in this space?
Yeah, but I think it's always been crowded. I mean, it was crowded 20 years ago when Peugeot left. It was apparently too crowded. But it's a competitive segment because it's a big segment, and they're all vying for a piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also have Genesis coming in as well at the other end. But I actually really like the portfolio that Alfa has put together. I think that like Jag, I think that they have to have an SUV to be competitive, because the demand for smaller luxury SUVs is it's growing and continuously. And so I like the fact that they've got several different options for consumers in the showroom today. Mm-hmm. I think that will serve them really well.
It's sort of like the Maserati plan, just, for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 less.
Exactly.
So Tony, I mean, when Reed was talking about how this is going to be the highest performance SUV, now this is going to be shown after the vehicle's launch. We don't know what it's called at this point. But is that really important to have a high-performance SUV?
I mean, it's important to our readers. I don't know how important it is to the typical car buyer.
Mm-hmm.
They just want, something quiet and reliable and that gets good fuel economy and is comfortable. And looks good, too. I don't know anything about the Alfa SUV at this point. If it is the quickest, then that sort of sticks with Alfa's game plan of being a performance brand. Mm-hmm. So
it's not too often.
I'm down with it, but I don't. We'll see.
I do think though that the early enthusiasm and success of the F-Pace from Jag, I think that does indicate that there are consumers out there that are interested in something else. Because, I live in Greenwich, Connecticut. If I see one more Range Rover driving around there, I mean, it's just like the official car.
Uh-huh.
And I do think that there is a desire to see something else.
Yes,
to get something else. And again, we have to always look at the demographics of the market. And I know I say that a lot, but it's because, it's changing. We've got millennials coming in, people in their 30s that are saying, you know, I'm starting to make real money now. I want to express myself. And then you've got Gen X also in peak earning years. And so you've got this opportunity to differentiate from the BMW, Audi, Mercedes lineup. And I think that that's where there's opportunity for Jag and Alpha. As the market is changing, as those demographics are changing, the market has just been, it's been, you know, the stranglehold of the baby boomers for decades. And it's just not the case anymore. And so that's why I think that there really is
There's a big opportunity there. Yeah, I mean, in Los Angeles, the 3 Series is basically a Camry.
Yes,
they put a lease special on it. And, you know, you just see seas of them.
You do.
And so, if you, like you said, if you want to stand apart from that, if you want something different, there's something different.
Right. There's your opportunity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you mentioned Genesis. Now, they're going to be having a SUV, so they're going to have two, aren't they? I mean, one is going to be a midsize or a compact.
Right now, they're just launching with the sedan, though.
Right, but
they're saying
within the next 2 or 3 years. And
right.
So, again, you know, the question becomes, are there too many choices? Now, they're not going to be playing up the performance like Jaguar and Alpha will be doing, but you know, they're vying for the dollar, right? And so, to your point, your readers certainly want the high performance, but what about the vast majority? Well, no, the vast majority does read Car and Driver.
Exactly.
We're not the lunatic fringe.
But I mean, it seems to me it's like a huge marketing struggle that these guys are going to have. You know, establish
yeah.
the brand and
the name recognition. I mean, I think there is some name recognition, but I think it's a pretty exotic name recognition. You know, if you say Alfa Romeo to somebody, they're going to think, you know, in the league of Ferrari, some like really exotic car. And then you see it on a sedan, and I don't know if that's going to make sense to them.
I was trying to think of the most famous Alfa that I could think of, and it's the one in the Graduate.
In the Graduate, the Spider. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and that was 1967.
Right.
You know,
right.
So.
A while ago. Yeah.
Hopefully they're not going to dust off Dustin Hoffman and bring him out.
I
would not recommend that.
There's the Super Bowl ad.
So, Tim, the whole technology play mm-hmm. in terms of the market right now. I mean, so we were talking about Audi earlier. Okay, those guys clearly have put many of their chips on the table
yeah.
saying, this is, you know, the performance we're pushing is going to be processor speed. You know, mm-hmm. we're going to be like hand in glove. We're going to really go at it.
Yep.
Now, from what we've heard from Alpha today is the fact that these guys are going after performance in terms of power and speed
right.
and agility and dynamics
mm-hmm.
and, yeah, Nürburgring lap times. Who wins?
That's a very good question, but ultimately, you know, those two things are actually pretty closely related because a big part of the speed of this car is the technology of the car. So the active torque differential, for example, on the rear end and the active suspension, those are things that are ultimately technology, and so those are helping the car to go faster. You take those off from the car, you delete those things, it's not going to be the world-class fastest production sedan in the world anymore. So having that kind of technology to make the car faster ties into the brand in a big way. But definitely, you know, when you talk about in-car technology, the infotainment system and things like that, this car definitely doesn't have anywhere near the number of bells and whistles that you'll see on a higher-end BMW or a Mercedes or an Audi. Whether that is a detriment or not, again, I think it depends a lot on the buyer. If we are talking about a baby boomer kind of buyer and that kind of thing, I don't think it's such of an issue in that case because,
right,
again, this
not.
Is a much more streamlined system. It's easier to use.
Right.
It's even higher contrast than a lot of the other systems that you see, which makes it easier to look at a
right.
glance. So
right.
in that way, that could actually be an advantage. But ultimately, you know, I think younger buyers do want more connectivity, and they especially want more connectivity to their smartphone. So that's something that I think will need to come to this car to continue to push down into a younger market.
And how difficult would it be to integrate that?
Ultimately, that just comes with partnerships with Google, partnerships with Apple. And that then turns into a situation of handing data over to those. You know, having Apple in your car means giving Apple some information about what people are doing in your car. Same with Google. Google wants even more information.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a matter of shaking the right hands and getting the right systems in the car. It's a right. relatively easy thing to do. But as we know, these cars take a long time to develop, so
right.
That could be years in the road.
Last word from you, Rebecca.
Well, to Tony's point about the reliability, the thing is that, you know, a lot of people will knock down a car, you know, as a reliable car. They don't like it because they can't deal with the telematics on it, you know, and so they'll be like, I hate this car because I can't get my phone connected, you know, and so I think it's good that they kept it simple. Mm-hmm. I like that they've just kept it to what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's a positive for them.
Intuitive system as well. It didn't feel lacking in any way.
Right.
Just didn't quite have as much functionality. But overall, I mean, I was really impressed.
Yeah, I mean, if they had chosen to do technology over the technology of performance, I think that would have been sort of inauthentic to the brand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I'd love to have both. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if Alfa Romeo is going to choose one, I can understand why they chose that.
Absolutely. Well,
of course. Don't we all?
All right. So with that, I'm going to say goodbye. So Rebecca Lindland from Kelley Blue Book, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Monica Roga from Car and Driver magazine.
Thanks for having me here.
That everyone reads.
That's right.
And Kim Stevens from Roadshow by CNET.
Thank you very much.
So join us all next week, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.